Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Obama administration is defending its passive surveillance policy of questioning and watching out for possibly ill people crossing the border with Mexico. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said today that restricting travel or closing schools is not yet necessary. But yesterday, the private Newberry Academy in Columbia, South Carolina closed, and today they announced two probable cases of swine flu at the school. And St. Francis Preparatory in Queens, New York remain closed today after an outbreak there. Kids in both schools spent spring break in Mexico. Let's start today with the woman at the epicenter of the outbreak in Queens, the school nurse. Mary Pappas has been a nurse for 27 years and school nurse at St. Francis Prep for the past six. 28 of the 50 known infections in the U.S. were at her school. Mary, it started last Thursday. What happened?
I was in my office. And it started the usual, you know, we have a very large amount of students, 2,600 in the school plus, so the usual came in. But I noticed around 9:30, 10 o'clock, a bunch of seniors were coming in one right after the other with fevers, which you don't usually see that close together. You know, I was monitoring that saying, So then I was trying to see if they were from the same homeroom, but I did notice they were seniors. And before I could really get a good handle on it, more came in. And then by 15 minutes later, I had a line. So I have two wonderful assistants that helped me. So we tried to just kind of screen and, you know, do at least the temperatures and see what's going on here. What's their chief complaint and what's their temperature? And when I saw that 80% of the kids on my line had a fever, I said, okay, we got something going on here.
And how many do you think were on the line at that point?
15.
Yeah.
At that point, it wasn't much later than 10 o'clock in the morning. I said, I got to go alert the principal. We have something going on here. And we kind of just did a quick size up, and we saw that the line was not getting any smaller. It was consistently staying. We had some, you know, accidents, vomiting, and so I had to reroute the line through the bathroom, which is like unheard of. You have to kind of like, it's a, kind of like an emergency exit, but we had to reopen it. And then that, the kids were just like, you could just see the despair on their faces. They were waiting, like, when are you going to get to me? You could just tell these kids were so sick one after the other. So then again, I said to my assistants, I gotta leave these again. Just keep on, you know, do the best you can. And I went to a private phone, and I called Dr. Krigsman, Department of Health, on his cell phone.
And this is the state authority?
This is the New York State Department of Health medical doctor, Dr. Krigsman. I had his cell phone because I used to work for the Department of Health, and I have a lot of contacts, and I try to keep very up-to-date and abreast of things because I am responsible for such a big school. So I called him right away on the cell phone, and he answered, and directed me right away to Ada Santiago, and she is the liaison, I believe, for, you know, the CDC and communicable diseases and that part of the Department of Health. So I spoke to her. She answered me, which was great, and she took care of contacting the CDC. They wanted to know who had fevers, who I sent home, who stayed. They were interested in the absence from the day before. They were going to be interested in the attendance today. And they were going to be interested in the attendance on Friday. They also wanted a copy of my logs, which is the book I keep, you know, in case people came in for a Band-Aid to differentiate the fevers,
right,
and how high they were. But pretty much after I had notified the Department of Health, anybody that didn't feel well, even without a fever, of course, we called the parent and gave them the option to take them home.
Okay, now at this point, Mary, you're talking to all these state officials. The line is still growing. People are getting, you know, kids are getting sick in the hall.
Mm-hmm.
Did anyone say swine flu? Did you have any idea what you were dealing with?
I had no idea. I thought maybe it was just a flu bug that had gotten in the school. One person who I sent home early said the parent called back and said the doctor said they had strep. But I knew that strep really wouldn't get this many kids sick.
Right.
You know, like it wouldn't spread so fast.
And when did you start to piece together, I wonder if this has anything to do with Mexico?
Later on in the afternoon, when people started saying, what is this? You know how people talk and different faculty were coming concerned. They were trying to, with the assistant principal, size up, like, okay, where did the tricks go? This one, I don't believe Cancun was supervised by the school. To the best of my knowledge, it wasn't. So sometimes the kids, they, you know, they organize this on themselves. So it takes a few minutes to figure out, actually a couple hours to figure out, you know, well, where did each group go?
And
it wasn't apparent to me by Thursday afternoon even the definite the time frame and who went, because it was unsupervised by the school.
How many children ended up getting sick?
I sent home 102 on Thursday alone. I believe 80 the next day, around 80.
Yeah. And they're still running tests, so you only have 28 of those confirmed. Do you suspect that, you know, what is that, sounds like almost 200 kids at the school have swine flu?
I don't think 200 kids, no, because if you listen to, like, the Department of Health, they have to have all of the symptoms, and they won't even test them. But I think it's going to be more, but it's not going to be 200 because so many kids had allergies and just weren't feeling well, but they didn't have fever.
Well, we know the school is closed, so you don't have contact with these students. But we hear from reports that they're all doing well. And some would say it's in part because of you, that you raised the red flag, you understood that something was going on. What, you know, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, some people, you know, they say, oh, you're a hero. You know, I don't feel as though I'm a hero. I feel as though I'm there for a reason. It's important that I'm there. And I just, you know, did my job, you know. And I think that's across the board. I think they need school nurses because for just this reason to, you know, we have instincts, we have the knowledge, and we need to be there for the safety of the kids.
Mary Pappas, school nurse at St. Francis Preparatory School in Queens, New York, where she raised the red flag and now 28 cases of swine flu have been identified. Mary, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, no problem. Thank you.
Let's turn now to Amy Garcia. She's also a nurse, and she's executive director of the National Association of School Nurses, which is based in Silver Spring, Maryland. Amy joins us from there. Amy, your thoughts on what Mary just told us? It seems as if, boy, she's an example of how things work well.
Mary's actions when she saw a number of students with high fevers is like a classic response of a school nurse, which is to identify trends and then to act upon those. School nurses pick up trends in infectious disease on a regular basis in schools, things like the regular flu, pertussis, MRSA, and other kinds of communicable diseases.
Well, and Mary works at a parochial school, but we understand that a quarter of U.S. public schools have no school nurses. Give us a snapshot of the situation for school nurses nationwide.
That's true. There's a very wide disparity between the states and sometimes within the states on how many students there are per school nurse. A child in Vermont is fortunate enough that there's one nurse per 275 students. If the same child moves to Utah, it's one nurse to almost 5,000 students. So that makes a difference in the kinds of things that school nurses can do on promoting health, teaching children how to be healthy in the future, and in identifying public health issues like this.
Well, you also say that privacy laws complicate a crisis response. We understand that written permission is required from a parent or caregiver before information about a child's health can be released. But Mary Pappas just told us that in her situation, the state, speaking for the CDC, did ask her for the names of the sick students.
And I know that Mary was working with parents at that point, and there are school nurses who get blanket authority ahead of time to talk with.
And so you're saying, and so you're saying, in normal situation, the privacy laws require you to get written permission from a parent, and that's difficult to do.
Yes, and we would like to see changes made that in any kind of a public health emergency situation, that there be good ways for schools and health departments and the Center for Disease Control to talk with each other. And the reality of the school systems today are that brothers and sisters often go to different schools,
right?
Sometimes in different communities. And so we've got to be able to improve the communications between all the key players so that all the children in the schools are safe.
And you're saying that right now, by the privacy laws, you have to have written permission from a parent, and that might take crucial time.
Absolutely. And, you know, parents have jobs, they're away at work, they may have limited English or other problems. So it's really important that we fix this little piece of the system.
Amy, we know the best advice to avoid getting sick at all and to avoid swine flu is to wash your hands constantly.
Absolutely.
But, you know, school nurses deal with kids. And these were juniors and seniors who came back from a trip, and they're going to see their boyfriends and girlfriends. I mean, I would think that, you know, in school, just they're kissing and things like that. I mean, this is where it really can spread.
Yeah, things do spread at school because children shed the virus more readily than adults.
It's a petri dish.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Amy, thanks so much.
All righty.
Amy Garcia, Executive Director of the National Association of School Nurses. Well, Mexico has closed all its schools, and today the mayor ordered restaurants in Mexico City to serve only takeout food. Let's touch down briefly there. Dudley Althaus is with the Houston Chronicle. Dudley, the World Health Organization has commended Mexico for its first response, but you write about a Seattle-based risk assessment firm that saw a worrying flu strain near a pig farm back on April 2nd. Now, you write Mexicans are questioning why they weren't warned until over a week after the first death on April 13th. So tell us more about the Seattle firm.
Well, this company, Veritech, claimed to be monitoring events worldwide that are social disruptions, what they call. And they picked up on this one town about 3.5 hours east of Mexico City that had a major flu outbreak back in April. And they put it on their website. That was April 2nd. By April the 10th, they were putting out warnings to the CDC and the Pan American Health Organization via email. I don't think they sounded the alarm very seriously, but they said it was on their website.
Well, and Mexico's health minister has said, why didn't you tell us?
Right, exactly. Well, I think right now there's a lot of buck passing. You know, I think that the fact that this company did put it out and did notice this, perhaps it should have been noticed by state and federal authorities here. But at the same time, I mean, to be fair, this was the end of the Mexico's flu season, and those mountains in particular where this village is located get very cold. There's respiratory illnesses and flu every year. And so it's not that unusual. It wouldn't cause that much alarm.
How is this hitting the economy if people can't go to school, can't eat in restaurants? What's the ripple effect that you can see?
I think it's going to have a major impact, at least on some of the economies, say in Mexico City and the larger cities. That said, businesses are still open. The mayor has said that if it gets worse or if he deems it necessary, he'll shut down the subway system and the extensive bus system in Mexico City by which a lot of the working class and poorer people get to work every day. So that'll cripple the city.
That's Dudley Althaus of the Houston Chronicle in Mexico City. Dudley, thank you.
Sure enough, Rob. Bye.
Okay, well, what about a swine flu vaccine? History may have some lessons for us, as we'll hear in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. The last time the U.S. faced a swine flu threat was in 1976. About 200 soldiers at Fort Dix in New Jersey got sick, one died, and the country went into a panic. The administration of then-President Gerald Ford launched a massive campaign, complete with television PSAs, that encouraged people to get a swine flu vaccination.
I don't need another flu shot. I had a flu shot last year.
A swine flu epidemic may be coming.
I'm the healthiest 55-year-old you ever seen. Hey, I play golf every weekend.
Get a shot of protection. The swine flu shot.
In the ads, the actors were first shown healthy and then very sick in bed. Well, 40 million Americans got those shots, but the pandemic never happened, and the vaccine actually made hundreds of people sick. Back in 1976, Dr. Richard Wenzel diagnosed two swine flu cases in Virginia, a sign that the virus had spread from New Jersey. He's now chair of internal medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. Dr. Wenzel, take us back to the 1976 outbreak.
Well, we had 230 cases at Fort Dix, 13 severely ill, and one death, as you pointed out. And then we described in 1976, my colleagues and I had two cases in Virginia suggesting that there were occasional cases outside of New Jersey. But the truth is, there was no spread beyond that.
So we have a cautionary tale here. And by the way, do we know the source of that swine flu in 1976?
I've never heard anyone say they exactly tracked it back to pig to human interaction and then adaptation. But presumably it was adapted, but not very efficient at transmitting from person to person.
Unlike the fears today that it has so far transmitted more person to person than people like to see, because it starts spreading exponentially, as we know. Well, so what happened after the news reports and the death at Fort Dix?
Well, I think what happened is there was an overreaction by healthcare policy experts advising President Ford. And I think when he went on television, there's a picture of the president getting the injection with his sleeve rolled up. I think the country overreacted, obviously. It's one thing to prepare the vaccine, another to drop the flag and give it.
Well, and this was a time when Americans were 30 years closer than we are now to the memory of the 1918 pandemic that killed 500,000 Americans and as many as 50 million people worldwide. How much of an influence was that?
I think that was probably in the minds of a few people, particularly senior medical advisors who had grown up, or at least new parents who had grown up in that era. Everybody is always referring back to that horrific epidemic.
And it was thought that it was caused in part by swine flu, but more recently people have decided that's not true.
It's true. I think that's an important point because, in fact, until the last few years, people thought that all influenza had to begin in some mixing and matching in a pig and then adapted to man. No one recognized, certainly in the mid-70s, that you could have a direct avian influenza from bird to man.
Which is what researchers have now determined, that it was avian flu in 1918.
That's correct.
Right. Tell us what went wrong with the vaccine program in 1976.
Well, two things occurred. One, there was never an epidemic. It never materialized. And the second thing that happened was there was a sevenfold increase in Guillain-Barré, a neurologic syndrome of weakness and paralysis. About 500 people got this Guillain-Barré syndrome.
Which is a sort of paralysis, which is temporary. Was it lasting in anyone who got it?
There's always a fraction of people who continue to have extreme weakness, if not paralysis.
And this cost the federal government millions of dollars in damages and also sort of damaged credibility. And, you know, as we said, acts as a cautionary tale. So how do you think this is factoring into the thinking today?
Well, that's a great question because I'm sure there's a long memory at the Centers for Disease Control. And in fact, after the disaster side effects, there was a big shakeup at CDC. And you correctly point out that for years, the public's reluctance to accept any vaccine was very, very high. So it had bad side effects. Mm-hmm. And I think people will remember that in every kind of decision, trying to find out, well, what's the time to really trigger a global growth in the vaccine program, and then when do you deploy it?
Right, and we understand that there is medication to treat swine flu, but to come up with a vaccination to prevent it would take about 2 months at this point.
At least 2 months if you have the cell technology that's relatively new, more like 5 or 6 months if some companies are still using the method to grow the virus in eggs.
But Dr. Wenzel, in your opinion, when should Americans be pushing for a vaccine?
I think there are two issues. One is, how communicable is this? In other words, for every one case, is there a secondary case? Or for every one, are there three or four? But the real clue today is, why did the patients in Mexico die? Did they die of flu? Did they die of a secondary bacterial infection? Is it the pollution down there? Is it a combination of more than one viral infection at the same time, flu plus a second virus? These are critical questions that I think the major focus today should be on why those patients died, and we haven't seen deaths elsewhere.
Right. And we're reading reports that these were not the vulnerable elderly or very young who died in Mexico, but largely healthy young people. And the reporting is that their bodies' immune systems went into overdrive. It's known as the cytokine storm. In fighting off the swine flu, you know, their systems killed them.
Well, in avian flu, we know that for sure. H5N1, the young people who died had a very robust immune reaction and overwhelmed the sort of checkpoints that usually kick in when the immune system kicks to a very high level. We don't know. We haven't seen the so-called cytokine storm measurements in the patients who died in Mexico. And again, that would be very useful to know whether that happened. But if that happened, why didn't it happen in the United States so far? And that's why I'm not sure that there's not something else in the environment, a second virus, a new bacterium, the pollution, combination of all those.
And so these questions need to be answered before a vaccine can be delivered. That's Dr. Richard Wenzel, who diagnosed one of the initial cases of American swine flu in 1976. He's now chair of internal medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University. Dr. Wenzel, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Okay, other breaking news we're following for you today. Republican Arlen Specter is reportedly switching parties, adding a vote on the Democratic side of the aisle. All the breaking news is next, here and now. Something of a political shocker is developing in Washington. Longtime GOP Senator from Pennsylvania Arlen Specter, who faces a tough re-election battle, is switching parties to become a Democrat. In a statement, the 79-year-old veteran of five Senate terms says he now finds his political philosophy more in line with Democrats. As a result, Senate Democrats might find themselves with a filibuster-proof majority in Congress and therefore control of both houses of Congress as well as the White House. Joining us on the line from Washington is Peter Walston, national political writer for the Los Angeles Times. And Peter, you know, Specter, longtime moderate, I'm thinking there might be two responses to this. One might be, what took him so long? And another might be, I didn't see this coming. You know, where are you?
It's certainly a surprise. I didn't see it coming at the moment, but you could see if you watched his Pennsylvania politics closely, you could probably see this coming. Those who do pay attention to Pennsylvania politics could see it coming for a couple of reasons. One, Pennsylvania has just been moving more and more Democratic. If you look at the numbers in the 2004 election and the 2008 presidential election, you can see that the suburbs around Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, which had been which were once pretty reliably Republican or at least swing areas, are now solidly Democratic.
Well, in fact, Specter points to that in his statement. He says, since my election in 1980, he'd written, you know, under the Reagan big tent, the Republican Party has moved far to the right. Last year, more than 200,000 Republicans in Pennsylvania changed their registration to become Democrats.
Yes, the political landscape there is just much different now, and Barack Obama won there fairly easily, and it was not going to. So Arlen Specter was going to have trouble winning re-election as a Republican, because with that change, also now the Republican Party is so, as he referenced in his statement, so much more conservative. He was going to have face a tough challenge in the Republican primary, and then to run as a Republican in that blue state was going to be also very complicated. So this is kind of the ultimate survivalist move by Arlen Specter in a way, and in that sense, it's not that surprising. But it's interesting, in your introduction, you said that this could be a filibuster-proof majority. You know, again, in his statement, he points out that he will not necessarily be the loyal 60th vote. And this could actually be very troubling. That while it seems like on the surface very good news for the Democratic Party, it could actually be very disturbing for liberal Democrats, because Arlen Specter is not going to go along with the party base necessarily. I mean, he even referenced in his statement his decision to oppose the Employee Free Choice Act, which, by the way, is the number one legislative priority of the American labor movement, a key piece of the Democratic base. And so Specter is saying that he's going to continue to oppose that, which means he's going to be a pro-business conservative Democrat.
Well, still, the Democrats are treating it as good news. President Obama has offered Specter full support. We have a quote here from the Associated Press, the president saying the Democratic Party is thrilled to have you. So they're going to, you know, count it in their column. And by the way, you mentioned that this might mean a 60-vote filibuster-proof Congress. That would be if Al Franken from Minnesota is definitely in office as well.
That's right, and I guess we still have to wait and see whether the Republican governor of Minnesota will let that move forward. And I'm just kind of absorbing all of this myself, so I don't know the interplay between Franken being seated and this Specter change. But again, I Specter is going to try to prove, you know, perhaps in a similar the way that Joe Lieberman has done, he's going to try to prove his independence. And one way he does that right up front in his statement is talking about this key labor issue, where he's saying right out of the box he's going to go against the labor movement.
Well, he writes in a statement, again, this is just a statement, there's a formal announcement expected tomorrow. Whatever my party affiliation, I will continue to be guided by President Kennedy's statement that sometimes party asks too much. When it does, I will continue my independent voting and follow my conscience on what I think is best for Pennsylvania and America. That words from Arlen Specter, who is expected to switch his party allegiance from Republican to Democrat, sending, you know, shockwaves through Washington. Peter Walston, along with everyone else, digesting this news for us. He's national political writer for the Los Angeles Times. Peter, thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin.
Okay, and before we go today, the long life of musical compositions from 17th century nuns. And we'll, of course, continue to follow the news, but we need a break, and we have some beautiful music coming for that. Back in just a bit, here and now. Majora Carter is one of the leading African-American voices in the push to create green jobs for inner-city blacks. Together with Van Jones of Oakland, California, she started Green for All, a national green jobs policy group. Jones has since moved to the White House as sort of Barack Obama's green jobs czar. Majora has launched the Majora Carter Group, a for-profit green economy consulting company. She was born in Hunts Point in the Bronx in New York, and in 1997, she returned from college and started working with a community organization, learning that the Bronx handled more than 40% of New York's, Manhattan's, solid waste, with 60,000 trash trucks passing through every day, contributing to diseases like asthma. Well, she led a successful fight to stop a new waste transfer station that then-Mayor Giuliani planned to build. And from there, she helped develop a nonprofit program, Sustainable South Bronx, to train Bronx residents, including recently released prisoners, to do environmental work, like planting rooftop gardens in neighboring Manhattan, for which she was awarded the MacArthur Foundation Genius Award. Her underlying theme, if wealthy communities suffered from air pollution as much as poorer neighborhoods do, the fight for fuel alternatives would have taken place long ago. Majora Carter now joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. And Majora, tell us, how many people ended up getting jobs out of your Bronx program?
Right. We started fairly small. We made all the mistakes that we hope no one makes ever again. We started with a 5-month long, paid training program that taught folks anything from yoga to the hard skills of wetland restoration. And it just cost way too much. And we were only able to train 6 people that first year. Moving along, we were able to train up to 60 people a year. So it was a really wonderful way that we were able to figure out how to make our program leaner, but still get people the job training skills in everything from wetland restoration to green roof installation, urban forestry management, brownfield remediation, or learning how to clean up contaminated land safely, and also providing folks with the soft skills, leadership development, learning how to show up and be present for a job, learning how to be a part of a team. Those are skills that many folks that we worked with real significant barriers to employment, because if they were formally incarcerated, they probably didn't have a whole lot of job experience. And also, if they were really entrenched in the social welfare system, they also didn't have much experience then either. So we had to make sure that the folks had hard skills as well as soft skills.
Where'd the money come from to do all this?
To start, we actually got a congressional appropriation or a portion of a congressional appropriation that went specifically to Bronx River restoration projects. Then later on, we did it mostly through private general support dollars that went to my agency.
So as you said, you've got people who live pretty much on concrete, suddenly mm-hmm. putting beautiful lawns and plantings in rooftops, and not just a way of collecting and using rainwater and storm spill-off, but cooling down buildings. For them, it's a job, but were you also able to change mindsets about why a green job was important for a largely minority community?
Right. I would actually say that for many of the folks, it was way more than just a job. I mean, believe me, they appreciated having money in their pocket that was legitimately earned in a truly dignified way. And it was because they knew that they were helping to support something bigger than themselves, the environment, and really create opportunities so that they could be contributors. Because we worked predominantly with people who were told pretty much since the day they were born that they contributed nothing to society, that they were in many cases worthless, would never amount to anything. And suddenly they're helping trees grow. They're helping, clean up forgotten contaminated land. And these are the kind of things that actually provide the kind of support system that people saw themselves as being a part of. I mean, it was a really beautiful, very powerful, empowering position to put people in.
We've talked to Van Jones about this as well, you know, the idea that initially it's hard to get someone to care about trees and grass when they're trying to keep their kids, you know, off the streets, off drugs. It sounds like a luxury that, the suburbs and a rooftop right. in Manhattan are able to afford, you know, to worry about greening things. But you're saying that they were able to see it closer to home.
In particular, for many Black people that were from the South and who had some understanding, you know, of what slavery was, you didn't want to see, you know, yourself connected to the land. You know, going to the city meant that you had arrived and done something bigger and better.
Yeah.
And I find it really curious that we've separated ourselves and allowed that to continue to happen when all, you know, huge bodies of research indicate that what people really want and need and actually thrive in are actually close interactions with nature.
Even in the
cities. Actually, especially in the cities. There's, you know, research that came out of the University of Illinois that showed that, you know, in some of the most notorious housing projects in the country, in Cabrini Green in Chicago, that if there was a little grove, I mean, we're talking little stick trees, you know, urban stick trees, that if there was, you know, a little bit of those, that the people who lived in that particular project, if they had a view of them, you know, girls' self-esteem went up, which meant that there were less teenage pregnancies in that area. Kids' test scores would go up because they were more able to concentrate, you know, on their schoolwork. That crime actually went down in those areas because people congregated outside more to be with each other, because community pride was lifted because of the presence of these trees.
Well, and you also point out, you're quoted as saying, after you went on a trip to the Arctic with environmental and political leaders, including former President Jimmy Carter and Senator Tom Daschle, you came back from that trip and said, I didn't need to go to the Arctic Circle to see the impacts of global warming. I'm living it. What are the particular effects of problems in the environment? We know them, too, but tick them off what you were talking about.
Well, environmental justice communities, you know, those that are the repositories for all of the kind of impacts, you know, environmental impacts that wealthier and usually whiter communities can avoid, are places like the South Bronx. They're places like Appalachia and coal country. You know, they come in many different colors, but predominantly they're poor. And they're point sources for greenhouse gas emissions, you know, either on the extraction side or on the burning side. And so when you're thinking about how do we deal with our global warming problem? You don't go to the place that's cold. You go to the place that's making the heat. And those would be the areas where you've got concentrations of power plants, of waste facilities, of huge quantities of diesel truck traffic, places where you're actually extracting the coal so that it can be burned. That's where you want to go and actually put some emphasis on dealing with that.
Because all of that is resulting in high asthma rates and other illnesses.
Well, it's resulting in local impacts, of course, you know, in particular asthma, obesity and diabetes, because parents don't want their kids often to go outside and play and get the exercise. Learning disabilities and young children have been linked to proximity to fossil fuel emissions. You know, when you've got areas that are point sources for greenhouse gases, the gases move. And that's why we're seeing the polar ice caps melting. So it would make sense, you know, for me, at least, to think, let's put some investment and some emphasis on dealing with those places that are point sources for where the greenhouse gases are actually being emitted.
That's Majora Carter, president of the for-profit Majora Carter Group for a Green Economy. She's also a MacArthur Genius Award recipient for her work in the South Bronx. She's been recognized by Newsweek as one of the world's environmental leaders of the century. Majora, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And we have just a minute to give you this heads up on a story we'll bring you later this week on Here and Now, when we meet one of the country's hottest theater directors. Diane Paulus has just taken the helm of the American Repertory Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Last summer, she brought her revival of the musical Hair to Central Park and then on to Broadway. It's earning rave reviews. Here she speaks about how audiences get to really feel the cast energy.
The actors at the Hirschfeld Theater on Broadway speak directly to the audience. They actually get off the stage, come down the aisles, climb the boxes, go in the balcony. Whether you're in the seventh row orchestra or in the very last seat of the balcony at the Hirschfeld, 1,400 seats back, the actors manage to get out in the audience and make personal contact with you.
This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, the age of Aquarius.
Diane Paulus on Thursdays, Here and Now.
Aquarius.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Back in 2006, we read letters from a Portuguese nun uncovering the mystery behind a 17th century forbidden love. Do you remember that? The book argued that the letters, which were a sensation in 17th century Europe, actually were written by a Portuguese nun. They weren't fiction from a man, as is commonly thought, because nuns in the 17th century were educated, independent. And our next guest would add, great composers. In fact, many 17th century convent nuns were actually able to publish their music under their own names. What you're hearing is O Dolce Anima Mia by Vittoria Aliotti, and it's just one of the pieces that was written during that time. It's performed by the Newton, Massachusetts-based group Capella Clausura, and joining us in the studio is the founder and director, Amy LeClaire. Amy, Clausura as in cloister?
As in cloister.
What drew you to this music?
I was a composer many years ago, and I realized that there were no role models, or I thought there were no role models, and so I went hunting around, and somebody turned me on to this whole era of music.
And what did you find about these cloistered women? Now, we mentioned the terrific book, Letters from a Portuguese Nun, about how these women were educated. Who were they?
They were mostly the daughters of the elite, the ones we know about. We don't hear about the ones who were the daughters of the poor. But the daughters of the elite entered, at least in Italy, entered the monasteries in huge numbers for a variety of reasons, probably the top of the list being that dowries were so competitive and so high that families basically sold their daughters into the convents as a way of having them fed and clothed and educated, but also as a way of avoiding having to pay dowries that were demanded by the marriage customs of the day.
Right, and they ended up, many of them, writing this exquisite music. Now, we were just hearing, as I said, the O Dolce Anima Mia. Mm-hmm. I have some of the lyrics in front of me. Oh, sweet soul, is it then true that changing your mind, you leave me for someone else?
Yes.
Now, that really doesn't sound like a nun talking.
Well, this is an interesting piece in particular because it's written by a woman named Vittoria Aliotti. She wrote these madrigals when she was probably about 15 or 16, so a young teenager. They were based on poetry that her father gave her. Her father understood that she had a gift of music. And she set these poems to madrigals. And so they're all about love and not celestial love. And then when she went on to become a nun, she began to write about more celestial things.
In fact, let's listen to track 11 from one of your CDs. Sei del tuo corpo?
Sei del tuo corpo.
Oh, it's better when you say it. What is Aliotti writing here?
She's writing, if today I look upon your body's terrible image and think about the wicked and cruel torment that you have borne for me hanging on the cross, and so on.
Yes.
So she's writing a love song to Jesus on the cross, and she's putting aside her past, really, her earthly past, in favor of this kind of devotion.
Well, in the convent, you know, there were some challenges with teaching women music. Mm-hmm. They were taught by men.
Yep.
The men, you write, had to be past the age of lasciviousness.
Yeah.
And they were taught behind screens?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, because they were cloistered, they were not allowed to be seen by anybody, especially men. And so men would come into the convents and teach. For example, a man would sit on one side of the screen and the nun would sit on the other, and the man would have a lute and the nun on the other side would have her lute, and he would talk to her through the screen, and they would have their lesson that way.
Let's listen to some more of the music it produced. This is Donna Lucrezia Vizzana, who, you write, wrote deeply passionate music at a time when artistic strife within the convent was at a peak. What do you mean by artistic strife?
Typical internecine artistic warfare. There were two different nuns who disagreed artistically. One was a very powerful maestra of the choir, and the other was, I gather, I'm a member of the choir. It's a little bit unclear, but they created some political disturbance inside their own little community. Young Lucrezia grew up with this kind of thing going on around her, and so her texts very often speak about making sure that my enemy doesn't win over me.
Oh,
beautiful. What's the name of this?
Usque quo oblivisceris me infinem.
Meaning,
how long wilt thou forget me?
So we've heard how women came to be composing in convents. When did they stop?
As near as we can figure, it stopped when the Napoleonic Wars happened and monasteries were destroyed throughout Europe. The nuns and monks were dispersed and just kind of sent away, and who knows what happened to them.
Yeah, and the music endured, but it doesn't have the full instrumentation on it, so are you you're guessing in places?
Here's the thing. With nuns, they really weren't allowed to have instruments. And so instruments would arrive, and then if the Vatican came along and said, no, 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 you can't do that, then the instruments would be taken away. And the amazing thing is that the nuns were able to write music so that it could be played by any number of forces that they had at hand.
Well, your latest CD features the music of the complete Vespers of Casalani.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about her and what makes her music hers.
She's an amazing composer. I would say that she's probably the most gifted of all the composers that we have found thus far. All of these pieces that we have discovered are very nicely done, but they're sort of small, they're sort of intimate, because the forces at hand just weren't there to write big, huge pieces. Cozzolani didn't seem to be bothered by that. She went ahead and wrote this huge, grand Vespers.
Let's listen to a little of the Magnificat. You know, we began by saying that as a composer, you were looking for other female composers.
Mm-hmm.
Now that you've found them, and I just saw your face, you know, when that chord was ringing there, and you get to sing them, what's that feeling?
It's just thrilling. It's thrilling not because I want to go back and become a composer anymore, but it's thrilling because I know that now if a young girl comes along in 2009 and hears this music and says, wow, yeah, I got a role model. Somebody was writing stuff that, you know, I don't have to be a guy to write music.
That's Amy LeClaire, director of Cappella Clausura, which is devoted to bringing music of cloistered women of the 17th century to modern audiences. Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. What a pleasure to be here.
For more information on Cappella Clausura, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.